Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joel Show podcast. Today on the pod, personal use of hard drugs is now decriminalized. Now what? Fiona Wilson from the BC Chiefs of Police, former Mayor Kennedy Stewart, and Minister Jennifer Whiteside join us as this historic pilot project takes effect in BC. Plus, the case against clearing tent cities. Is Canadian case law making it impossible for municipalities from clearing homeless encampments? That's all next on the Jazz Joel Show podcast.
Present situation through the lens of law enforcement. Joining us now is the Deputy Chief in the Vancouver Police Department, Fiona Wilson. Ms. Wilson, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Jazz.
So an important day, an historic day. It is a pilot project. Mm-hmm. Walk us through law enforcement's view of all of this. I know you support it. Give me a sense of what today means to you and your members.
Well, you know, I think police in British Columbia and certainly the Vancouver Police Department, we have a long history of advocating for progressive changes to drug policy. Today marks an important milestone because, you know, one of the things that we've been advocating for a long time is decriminalization, along with things like treatment on demand and safe supply. So I think it's very important to recognize that decriminalization is only a very small piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. It's an important piece of the puzzle. It's not going to solve the problem of illicit drug overdose deaths, but combined with all of those other things that I just mentioned, including education, prevention, treatment on demand, we're hoping that it can achieve the goal that, you know, we all have to reduce those dramatic number of overdose deaths.
Broadly speaking, how often have your members arrested anybody with 2.5 grams of hard drugs over the last few years?
That's a great question. You know, at the VPD for many years, we have not been recommending charges for the most part in relation to people who are in simple possession of illicit drugs. So I believe our number last year, for example, was 3 requests for charges to Crown Council. And that's primarily because we recognize that, problematic drug use is a health matter. It's not a criminal matter. And, you know, the last thing we want to do is criminalize people because of their challenges with addiction and or mental health. So, over the last number of years, and those examples, those 3 examples from last year, for example, they would be exceptional circumstances. Like there were other mitigating factors that led to the recommendation for charges. And prior to that, for a number of years, we average about 5 a year. And when you consider that we go to 700 to 800 calls for service a day, that's a tiny, tiny, tiny number.
So as much as, and I don't want to trivialize this, but as much as we have made today the first day in regards to the law, we basically have decriminalized the use of hard drugs for many, many years here in the city of Vancouver.
You nailed it, Jazz. We sure have. The only big difference is that historically, despite the fact that we wouldn't arrest someone for small amounts of personal possession, we would often seize those drugs. And that is a big departure from what will happen now that decriminalization or the exemption under Section 56 of the CDSA has come into place. Mm-hmm. So we won't be seizing drugs either that are under that threshold of 2.5 grams. So that is a bit of a difference. We weren't always doing that, of course, but we average, I would say, about 50% of the time we were still seizing drugs because, you know, of course, our members are thinking, boy, if I don't take this person's drug, they could go around the corner and overdose and die, knowing how poisonous the drug supply is. So that is quite a big change that we'll see moving forward.
I just look at this conversation through the lens of just being a reporter from the early 1990s, like 91 to today, and it is a significant change not only for law enforcement but for society in general. There's got to be a lot of years where you as a police officer and as a police department felt like you're a scapegoat for everything that's happening. If you try to make arrests, you've got activists challenging you, accusing you of police brutality. And now here we are, we're talking about decriminalization. Where does law enforcement fit in today? I mean, to a certain degree, do you feel that at the very least, some of the challenges that law enforcement's had to deal with, like I said, being accused of brutality or being accused of picking on folks that have these substance abuse issues, does that take a weight off police departments as well?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, our officers have experienced over the years, and certainly I have in my career, and I can liken this to, you know, apprehending people over and over again, sometimes in the same shift, by virtue of behavior that was as a result of them suffering from the effects of a mental illness. You know, it never feels like the right thing to do to put someone like that in jail. When you know that really in your heart, it's a matter that should be dealt with more appropriately through health channels. And it's the same thing with people who have addiction challenges with illicit drugs. You know, taking somebody who is in that those circumstances and putting them in jail, I could tell you, like, it just never felt like the right thing to do. And thankfully, in Vancouver for many, many years, we've really focused our attention on people and organizations that are importing, producing, and trafficking in illicit substances, and away from those individuals who themselves are really struggling with addiction.
So the people listening to this are going to go, well, where does law enforcement fit into this? Where does enforcement in general, you've talked a little bit about the drug dealers, does this give you any more resources to go after them, do you think? I mean, because that's part of it. I think there's a large part of the population still that remains mm-hmm. skeptical, not that they don't have a heart, not that they don't have empathy. They just have difficulty with us decriminalizing, even for a pilot project, hard mm-hmm. drugs, mm-hmm. where if your resources aren't going to be spent on the front lines in regards to some of these individuals that have challenges before them, where do you think those resources, or do you have any extra resources to deal with the drug dealers, the, you know, bigger, broader transnational crime groups that are bringing all this stuff in here?
Well, honestly, Jazz, because we've had basically de facto decriminalization for small amounts of personal possession of illicit drugs in Vancouver for many, many years, it's not like we've been dedicating this host of resources towards that in any event. So I wouldn't say that we have any extra resources. But what I can say is that we have a lot of practice now, a lot of years under our belt, where we have been focusing our resources on those higher level individuals and organizations that are really causing the most harm. One of the things that we've been doing now for many years is redirecting those resources that typically, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s even would have perhaps been focused on street level enforcement. We have been, you know, over many years redirecting those resources to that higher level of enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Deputy Chief Wilson, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
To get to this point when it comes to politics requires a significant amount of discussion and negotiations behind closed doors. Those are never easy. Now, the man who is front and center when it comes to having that conversation is former Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart. He is coming out with a new book called Decrim, How We Decriminalized Drugs in British Columbia. He talks about what's happening behind the scenes and also the broader conversation of why British Columbia is headed in this direction. The book, to my understanding, is coming out in May, but this is very important today, and it was important to have him on the show as well. He joins us now. Today, he is the director of the Center for Public Policy Research at Simon Fraser University. Kennedy, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, great to be here, Jess. Thanks for having me.
So what's today mean to you? I mean, you were negotiating behind the scenes. You've been a mayor, of course. What's this day mean to you?
Well, it depends what hat I'm wearing. First and foremost, as someone who's lost a family member to toxic drugs, it means a lot to our family that death has a meaning, that there's mm-hmm. some meaning behind it. And so that, and I think many families across British Columbia, too many, are feeling the same way, is that any kind of change is important. As a policy maker, as a former mayor and MP, this is important, I think, that shows that Canada's heading in a different direction when it comes to moving away from the war on drugs and moving more to a much more health-centered approach. And then finally, as a public policy professor, I think that this shows, you know, presents an opportunity to show how these policies can be changed in the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, some have said, look, they've tried this in Oregon or in the midst of that conversation. Many people talk about the Portugal model. There have been critics of both models as well, that it hasn't done what many felt it was going to do, and it hasn't been as successful as some people have said it is, particularly around the Portugal model, that these successes are not black and white. What makes you think we can succeed here in British Columbia?
Yeah, well, for me, it's, I guess, is what you think success is. So, you know, the overall thing that we're all looking for is reduction in toxic drug overdoses and, of course, death, which is really the most grim statistic that any kind of policymakers can deal with. But there's a number of kind of sub-indicators. For example, one that's not talked about as much is the seizures of drugs. So, so we know from the police, and I'm sure Deputy Chief Fiona Wilson told you this, that there's not that many arrests in Vancouver, at least.
Mm-hmm.
There are more across the province and other jurisdictions, so they don't make a difference province-wide. But what there are a lot of is drug seizures. And so if you're caught with small amounts of drugs, one of our students actually at the School of Public Policy did her master's on this, was that half of the seizures of drugs, which there are a lot, thousands, are actually under this threshold. So police are still seizing small quantities of drugs from folks that are caught with them. And this is like, to me, it's kind of like, you know, you meet some teenagers on the beach and you pour out their alcohol and let them go on their way. This is kind of what police are doing on a very regular basis right across the province, running into folks that have small quantities of drugs, taking them away, and then letting them go on their way. Unfortunately, what happens in those cases is a lot of those folks that are very dependent are forced into very risky behaviors to try to secure the drugs that they need to function. So that's where I think the biggest difference will be through this policy.
You talked about the negotiations that go on behind closed doors, raising the profile of this issue. Walk me through what that was like when you first brought this issue up in the corridors of power, not just here in BC, but more importantly in Ottawa, because this is ultimately a federal law. This is a pilot project, but it's a federal law. Walk me through some of the skepticism or perhaps questions you dealt with behind the scenes.
Sure. So elected in late 2018, but in 2019, we were actually seeing quite a drop in the number of deaths due to toxic drugs. And so a lot of the focus at that point was safe supply. So I remember being on a panel with Dr. Bonnie Henry and talking to, Dr. Patricia Daly and all the health advisors in British Columbia. And in 2019, the whole focus was on getting safe supply programs up off the ground. But after the pandemic hit, that changed things radically. The drug supply changed very significantly, and we've had a massive spike in deaths. And so that's when all policy options kind of came on the table for some of us. And the Prime Minister told me twice to my face in 2019 that he was never going to decriminalize drugs. The Premier was, Premier Horgan at that point, was reluctant.
Mm-hmm.
But it took the work of activists, really, to really drive this to the federal level, and in the end convinced us at the city to make an application for an exemption at the citywide level. Then the province quickly followed with their province-wide exemption application, which was takes effect today.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a long and winding road to get here, and I think that's a really important story to understand for folks who want to move further in this direction or do any policy change, is that how much work it takes. You know, lots of people saying, you know, this isn't going to solve things and it's not that big a change, but how much political work it takes to get something like this done is worth understanding.
Some have said, look, we're a G7 nation with a strong social safety net in the grand scheme of things, and it's odd for British Columbia and Canada to take sort of this libertarian hands-off approach, and that we should instead be focusing on more beds, first of all, for treatment. Yeah. We're at about 3,200, I think, in this province. 320 have been added since the NDP were elected in 2017. More needed. But look, focus on those treatment beds, focus on issues around housing, employment, and healthcare. That's where our focus should be. not on decriminalizing these drugs, even for personal use. What do you say to that argument?
I agree with a lot of it. I do think that treatment, I mean, we, while I was mayor, we approved the biggest drug treatment center in British Columbia, which is going on Clark Drive. So that has been approved, and the province will be constructing that soon. So I absolutely agree, and, you know, I've had many friends who have gone through treatment, so that's definitely important. But what we have to realize is that 80% of very hard drug users, like heroin and cocaine and increasingly other opioids, relapse. About 80% of them relapse. And so treatment is going to work for a small proportion of people, you know, and I guess the dream is that you get off drugs forever and you're always clean. But in many, many cases, that's not the effect, and people are on and off drugs for their entire lives. And so we need a kind of real everything we can have. Excuse me. So decriminalization is important. Treatment's important. Safe supply is probably the most important thing we can move out, that people get off of these poison drugs and you know, live their lives in a much more predictable way. But, of course, housing and all those jobs and everything else are all important, because at the root of all this is often trauma. And trauma comes from many, many places. But one thing we always have to be conscious of is, of course, we've recently nationally declared that we have committed genocide here in Canada. And a lot of the trauma, that resulting trauma, does end up, unfortunately, leading to, you know, substance abuse, substance use, and a lot of that is poison drugs. So this is, you know, affecting Indigenous people more than anybody else, and that needs to be factored into.
My final question to you, people have some pointed to Oregon as a place that has decriminalized hard drugs. Portugal, people talk about the Portugal model, and there are a lot of folks who point to it and say, look, there's lots of success there. Others have said, look, there has been some success, certainly, but they've also implemented other things beyond just decriminalization, which is, you know, guaranteed minimum income, housing assistance, all those wraparound services that we often talk about. First of all, do you believe those two particular jurisdictions have been successful at it? And if we do what they do, would you view it as a success, or do you think we need to do more? Because if it's just those two jurisdictions, many people have said they have not been complete successes, and we're kind of flying blind here a little bit with this experiment.
Yeah, I think that all success is going to be to a degree. It's never going to be, you know, you're in the fix that you're in now with just really a huge number of people dying unnecessarily, and to a point where you're at zero and nobody's using drugs anymore. You're going to have some middle ground. So for me, the number one metric that will show success initially is that the number of people dying decreases significantly to a point where it was, you know, in the 1980s, we would have, you know, very, very low levels of overdose. And now, since that point, it is just, you know, 10, 20, 30 times that level. So I think that's what all health policy analysts are looking at, is how do we not just keep people alive, but make sure they have better lives. So that's really what really the measure should be. Although that, you know, again, when we talk about statistics and outcomes, it's a pretty cold way of looking at individual people who are really having very, very tough lives and at risk of death daily. So we always have to keep in mind the individuals that are living this, and it's a pretty brutal life in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Kennedy, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Interesting court decision last Friday that we haven't talked about. I don't think anybody's really talked about it. It didn't actually occur here in Vancouver or in British Columbia. It actually occurred in the Ontario Superior Court of Justice, and some people are saying it's precedent-setting. The decision that came down basically said that it's unconstitutional for municipalities to clear homeless encampments from public property if there are not enough accessible beds in the shelter system to house the homeless population. So it violates their rights. Now, the case involved the municipality of Waterloo in Ontario, and regards to an encampment there they wanted to get rid of. The decision, however, builds on earlier decisions from British Columbia. And they could have, obviously, implications on municipalities in Ontario and potentially BC as well. We're going to check in with John Green, who's a lawyer at John Michael Green Law Corporation. We wanted to chat with him about this decision in Ontario and what it means potentially here in British Columbia. John, thank you for joining us. So walk me through, is this precedent setting for British Columbia as well?
Nope. British Columbia already had gone to the extent that the judge in Ontario had gone to. So this, the judge in Ontario actually looked to the British Columbia Court of Appeal and what they had done in a decision called Adams, I think back in about 2009, which was followed by our Chief Justice in a more recent decision called Stewart. And basically those decisions stand for the law that if the cities don't have beds for the number of homeless people in the city at that given time, then those people are permitted to stay in public spaces.
I often get calls on this show and other talk shows from folks who are quite angry sometimes when they see these homeless encampments, tent cities, that said, look, why aren't police moving in? Why are municipal politicians not doing anything about this? I think the last mayor, Kennedy Stewart, dealt with a lot of that as well. It essentially, what you're telling me, it just comes down to the law. If you do not have space in shelters for these individuals, there is no way that you should be moving them.
Yeah, I think I used to think like that too, but I actually think I'm kind of ignorant for thinking that way. I think the first thing when you start to look at it is, and what the judge in that decision in Ontario did and the judges in British Columbia do is they kind of look at, are the people in these places, like who are they and are they dangerous? And the Ontario decision kind of walks through that, like, because the city, some of the evidence that they tried to lead to talk about that, it was kind of funny. So they actually permitted cross-examination of the city's person that advanced this position. And they said they counted 8 people that were quote-unquote suspicious persons without any definition, the judge said. And then they said that they developed a risk rating system. And the judge quoted, he said, the region shows 20 tents as an indicator of high risk because they thought, quote, 20 made good sense, unquote. The judge ended and said, I find that there was little or no analysis to justify the decision. And it was, the judge goes on like that just to go through the data that was given to him by the city. And I think he did that on the danger side. He said basically there's no danger to these encampments when you really look at it. And then the other thing he said was, let's look at the beds and let's look at the situation when a city comes to us and says, like, look, we've got 200 beds and there's 200 people inside, so this should just go away. And the judge said, okay, well, let's look at what these beds actually look like. And when he did the analysis and walked through all the beds that the city said they had available, it wasn't even close to the number that the city was coming in front of the court to say they had. So I think it's probably like that a lot of the time. I know I used to work downtown at one of the did the legal clinic at one of the under one of the shelters and stuff, and these are pretty restrictive places, and the data on that was used by the court is about 95% of these people they're active opiate addictions, right? So these people run on cycles where the addiction or the medications wear off, the drugs wear off, they go into withdrawal, the withdrawal is just awful. They have to use the medications again, but if they can't get in and out, these people are going to choose to stay out because they can't live like that. So
does tie the hands of elected officials, though, who do have to deal with the brunt of public frustration. People don't want to see it, never mind the issues which you've articulated very well. And we're going to be speaking to the Minister of Mental Health and Addiction after the 5 o'clock news on these issues. But you've articulated it well, but people just don't want to see this stuff. They don't visually want to see it. This is not what downtown's about. I use downtown generally. It happens in the suburbs as well. That people just don't want to see this stuff before them. How do we deal with this in an appropriate manner? I guess it's still going to come down to more money, more beds, and if we can't, these things may be much more permanent than we think.
I'm going to stick to the political side away from the legal side. And these encampments, like I was down in Portland, they're even worse than Vancouver. Seattle's got massive ones. They're in Mission, Maple Ridge. They've sprung up everywhere. And I think that if you really look at the data, they sprung up to coincide with the rise of the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And they sprung up in, you know, as property prices have just far outstripped anything that a lot of people can afford. And so, I mean, those two things put together, I think, is what causes it. And the data that the judge cited, 79% of these people in, and I was trying to do the math, but about 79% of the people that are in these camps are white males. Like, and so there's a lot of focus. I mean, it's still bad. There's lots of women in them and everything else, but this is the, I mean, it's crazy. It's the base for Pierre Poilievre, effectively, that's in these camps. You know, these are, I'd expect if they started actually asking these people how they ended up there, a lot of them would say, I was hurt at work. I was prescribed opioids. I started using them outside of that because I was having withdrawal symptoms even then.
Mm-hmm.
And no one gave them help. And I have cases like that right now.
Wow.
So it's the base. That's the people that are in these places. I mean, they're soccer coaches, they're welders. These are people. The guy whose case I have in Thursday on court,
mm-hmm.
he was a soccer coach. He was a welder. He hurt his back at work. He went and saw his doctor and for 3 years was given opioids.
And
that's who's there. And the problem is, I think our province has never really looked at helping any of these people the way they need to. And that's to say, look, you guys actually have legal cases against a lot of these doctors.
Yeah.
These people don't even know, right? They can't manage their own lives, let alone, run these cases. And they don't. The doctors don't tell them.
Yeah. It is amazing. We have 3,200 treatment beds, to my understanding, in this province. We've added about 320 since 2017 when the NDP were in power. And when you look at that number, you still go, you know, that's it. We got to have with this opioid crisis that we're all seeing in our city and across North America. You sort of go, wait a minute, that's it. And that's not a commentary on the NDP, it's a commentary on BC Liberals as well. Like we've been hit with this thing, this tsunami, the tsunami of deaths, lives destroyed, and we still only have 3,200 beds. So decriminalization is one thing, but the broader issue of how people are actually ending up dying or ending up in these tent cities that you and I are talking about, we actually need to spend more money on a lot of this, don't we?
Yeah, imagine how bad it would be if the 11,000 people that died since they declared it was a health crisis were still alive.
Yeah, no, that's it. You're absolutely right.
There'd basically be a full city of people.
Yeah, I actually had some friends. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's impacting all of our downtowns. I mean, I have friends who took their kids to a basketball game watching the Portland Trail Blazers, and they're planning to spend a couple of nights there, visit the city. But the homeless population, the tent cities were so bad, they left after one night. They said, this is crazy. This is a war zone. Yeah. We're out of here. Yeah. And they just left.
Yeah, and Portland changed, like, basically from the point that that COVID started to the point that, you know, like, we were allowed to go back down there. Like, it was, like, night and day.
Yeah.
Like, it obviously carries serious problems. Like there's people that are opioid addicted, they want to get money so that they can buy more. And so they break in. I mean, I had my car broken into twice when I lived down in the West End. I mean, I had it broken into in front of the courthouse. that happens, and so these things carry all kinds of problems if they're not addressed. But, you know, like there are some really simple, I think, solutions to this that like, just have never been addressed. Like, we don't have enough psychologists in this province. We do not have enough psychiatrists in this province. Like, not even close.
Yeah, there's a broader it's a broader health challenge because our system runs at 95% pre-pandemic, and now everything seems to be falling apart. And that's part of the reason is the system has always been run at nearly 100%, and everything else that it's sort of coming downstream now is because of that challenge we've had. John, thank you so much for your time, my friend. Really appreciate your time today.
Okay. You bet, Jeff. Have a good one.
Let's revisit our top story today, of course, is the first day in our province where you won't criminally prosecute adults who are caught with less than 2.5 grams of hard drugs, including heroin, cocaine, fentanyl, ecstasy, morphine. BC will be the first jurisdiction in Canada to remove criminal penalties for possession. Many people across this country, across the world actually, are watching this pilot project. Since 2016, BC's declared a public health emergency. Nearly 11,000 residents have died of illicit drug deaths. Joining me now to talk about decriminalization is Jennifer Whiteside. She's BC's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions. Minister, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Jazz. Happy to be here.
It's a very historic day as this province begins a 3-year journey with this pilot project. Is decriminalization enough in regards to tackling this big issue?
Well, you know, Jazz, decriminalization really, it's one tool in the toolbox. and it has a very specific purpose, which is really around decriminalizing people who are using drugs and who are carrying small amounts for personal use. It really is about breaking down stigma and shame and the fear associated with using drugs.
Now, some would argue, would obviously agree with you, but would say, look, shouldn't the focus be on treatment? Why not focus on more rehab centers, a greater focus on more housing? They've argued that our neighbor, Alberta, is focusing in that direction rather than focusing on decriminalization. What do you say to that argument?
Well, you know, decriminalization is really about decriminalizing the people who are using drugs, you know, many of whom will have challenges with substance use disorder that need to find a pathway to care and support. It's in response to a call that has been made by people with lived experience, by law enforcement, by public health. So we've had a wide range, a very diverse range of partners come together at a table to sort of, you know, shepherd our application for the exemption to the federal government forward, and who will now, of course, continue to meet. So again, it is not a one thing or another on this in terms of how we respond to the toxic drug crisis. We have to do all the things. We have to continue the work that we've done, of course, to build out treatment spaces, to build out counseling, to build those pathways in our healthcare system so that people can access care and supports. Mm-hmm. And that's been a big focus of the $500 million investment that we made in Budget 2021, is, you know, working towards building out those services.
How many more treatment beds do you think this province will be able to open over the next couple of years, or at least even over the next 3 years, as this pilot project, as we monitor this pilot project, how many more treatment beds do you see in the upcoming year or two?
Well, you know, we have just in excess of 3,200 beds providing a range of services in the province. You know, that includes over 320 that we've added since 2017. You know, the health authorities are working hard with our many community partners who provide many of those services, as well as our sort of main partner, the Canadian Mental Health Association, which also provides those services. So we're looking to add beds all the time. Minister Dix just announced last week the expansion of sobering beds on the North Island. You know, we've opened sobering beds in Prince George. We continue really every week to make announcements about new and expanded services. And we'll continue to do that, because that is such an important part of a key pillar of how we are combating the toxic drug crisis.
As many people would argue, you know, the 3,200 number and the 320 you've added is wonderful, but there's a lot more needed. Is there any talk of adding more budget for you, for the health ministry as well, to add significantly more treatment beds in the months and years ahead?
Well, we know that we need to be investing in all of the pillars that are supporting our approach. So the pillar that is related to community counseling services, for example, child and youth mental health through integrated child and youth teams, which are connected to schools, to our foundry services. We have 13 foundries operating now. We will have 23 by the end of next year. Those are very important services. And of course, yes, more different kinds of treatment spaces for people, as well as our efforts at separating people from the toxic drug supply through more access to prescribed safe supply. That's important. So all of these pillars are important, and this is a commitment that our government made. We made it with a significant investment, a $500 million investment in 2021. I mean, we're continuing to work with partners on the ground to build out these services. But I think it's really important to note that, you know, when we formed government in 2017, what we had really inherited was a collection of fragmented services. There had been no concentrated effort to pull together a system of mental health and substance use care and treatment and support. No effort made to really integrate that work into our healthcare system. And so that's the difficult work that we're doing now, is working on the ground with health authorities, with community service providers, to really pull all of those services into into our healthcare system so that we see mental health and substance use care as really part of primary health care.
How do you define success when it comes to this 3-year pilot project for decriminalization? Some people may still be uncomfortable with it because it is not something we would have thought about 10, 15, 20 years ago. It is a different way to look at those who are dealing with substance abuse. But it is a 3-year pilot project. So how do you define success
right.
in regards to decriminalization?
Well, there'll be a number of measures, a number of criteria that Health Canada is looking at that they will be working with the Canadian Institute for Health Information on assessing over the course of their very sort of in-depth research project that is happening with respect to the pilot. But importantly, our core planning table, which has all of those partners I mentioned earlier, law enforcement, people with lived and living experience, public health providers, municipalities, will be working with everyone who is on the front lines of this crisis to understand how decriminalization is rolling out and where we need to be responsive to that. And I think that was a commitment that Dr. Henry made yesterday at the announcement, was that, you know, we will need to hear from people so that we can be responsive as it rolls out. But we'll be looking to see does that interaction, or are we gaining ground on destigmatizing the situation that people who use drugs are in? Are they able to reach out for care and support? Are there resource cards, which is the information that police are going to be providing to people when they're in those encounters, which is about connecting them to care and supports? Are people taking up those opportunities? Are they connecting with the substance use navigators that we now have in health authorities, who are people at the end of a phone when somebody calls? Are we seeing those numbers shift in terms of the people looking to access care and support? And how importantly, how are police experiencing? How are frontline officers experiencing the work and their important contribution to trying to change the nature of that encounter from one that puts an individual on a sort of criminal justice path as opposed to putting them on a healthcare path?
Final question to you. You know, I was reading about, obviously, today on the BBC website, Fox News is covering it, many other jurisdictions around the world are covering it. It's not just a local conversation or a national one, but an international one. As a minister, what goes through your mind in regards to the enormity of this change and this pilot project, number one? More importantly, what do you say to taxpayers who are listening to this today and they say, look, well, I understand where the minister's coming from, but I'm very hesitant with, you know, making these drugs legal or a small personal amount. They still are uncomfortable with it. What do you say to those taxpayers?
Well, I want to say first and foremost that it's important to remember that decriminalization isn't legalization. What we have is an exemption from the enforcement of federal law that continues to be in place, that continues to name certain areas as continuing to be criminal. So these drugs are not permitted on school grounds. They are not permitted to be carried or used by people who are younger than 18. There are certain other exemptions for people working in federal services. So the federal government has been very, I think, prudent in their approach to the parameters that they've placed around this pilot project, recognizing that what we are trying to get at is those individuals who are carrying small amounts for personal use, who may well have a substance use issue that we need to try to support them in addressing. So that's really the objective here, and it's about the stigma. And I really go back to Catherine Blotchford and her incredibly courageous presentation yesterday at the announcement for decriminalization, just about not only the stigma that her husband, who died to a toxic drug poisoning, not only the stigma and fear that he must have felt, but how that carried on to her and her family and her children, and the challenges that they've had in overcoming that. And I think we have to remember this is our loved ones, our neighbors, people in our community, and we have to help. We have to step up and help and be there as a community for people. So today, I'm thinking about the 2,272 people who lost their lives last year to the toxic drug crisis.
Minister, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Jazz Joe Hall Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can always listen to the Jazz Joe Hall Show live Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. on 980 CKNW and connect with me on Twitter at Jazz Joe Hall BC. Talk to you next time.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.